starting this new year by looking at miracles that Jesus did, and particularly in John's Gospel, the seven signs that we find there. John's Gospel was probably written after the other three Gospels, and it's very different in tone. It contains some miracles that aren't found in the other three Gospels. But John isn't content just to show us Jesus is a miracle worker, though, you know, there are miraculous signs there. But he uses those signs to teach us different things about who Jesus is, what his miracles mean for us. Seven, as you probably know, was the Jewish number of perfection. And John clearly thought about that when he was writing his gospel. He chooses to give us different ways of looking at Jesus, which reflect that perfection. He gives us seven I am statements about Jesus' identity, his identity as God. So we've looked at those a little bit last year, the special names that Jesus had, you know, where it says, before Abraham was born, I am. And then we find out that John talks about him being the bread of life, the light of the world, the true vine, the good shepherd, the gate for the sheep, the resurrection and the life, and the way, the truth and the life. And each of those statements obviously help us to see something of who Jesus really is. And in the same way, John chooses seven miracles that Jesus did. He focuses on those signs to show us not only what Jesus actually did, but what those signs mean to us now. So as I say, we will look at other miracles in other Gospels as well, but for now we're looking at those seven signs in John's Gospel. Last time we looked at how Jesus turned water into wine at the wedding at Cana. And today we're going to have a look at the second sign, how Jesus healed the son of a royal official, which we find in John chapter 4 and verses 46 to 54. We said last time, you know, that turning the water into wine at that wedding was quite a domestic miracle. Other people may not have really known much about it, but it shows us how Jesus was involved in his community and involved in everybody's ordinary everyday life, how he cares for us, you know, in our ordinary everyday lives. And for this next miracle, we're back in Cana in Galilee, and we see how he healed the son of a certain royal official, even though that son was in Capernaum, which was 20 miles away. So if you could just move on, Gary. I've got a reading from John chapter 4. So verses 46 to 54, and that says, once more he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and he begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. Unless you people see signs and wonders, Jesus told him, you will never believe. The royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. Go, Jesus replied, your son will live. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. When he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that the boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday at 1 PM, the fever left him. Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. So he and his whole household believed. This was the second sign Jesus performed after coming from Judea to Galilee. So Jesus was already preaching and teaching. He was travelling around by the time this second sign happened. In John chapter 2, we saw him in Jerusalem at the temple courts, how he was baptising in the countryside in Judea, and how he had that conversation with Nicodemus in John chapter 3. At the beginning of John chapter 4, the early parts of this chapter, we see him travelling through Samaria. He meets the woman at the well there. And, you know, her life and that community are revolutionised by their meeting with Jesus. Now he's back in Galilee. He's once again in Cana, and we're reminded that that's where the first miracle happened. And we're introduced to this royal official. We're not given any further details about him. Just, you know, as far as the story's concerned, the fact that his son lay sick at Capernaum. Now, Capernaum was about 20 miles from Cana. It could be that this official came to see Jesus as soon as he heard that he was in the area. We don't really know anything about the man, except that he worked for the royal official, Herod, in other words, who was the governor of that area. Sometimes there are mentions of people working for Herod in the Gospels. Joanna and Cusa mentioned in Luke chapter 8. Manaen is mentioned in Acts 13, verse 1. It might be that one of those was the royal official, but we really don't know. All we really know in terms of what is important for this story is that the son was close to death. Now, I think it's quite remarkable that at this early stage in Jesus' ministry, somebody realizes that Jesus has power to heal. You know, he's been in the temple, he's quoted from Isaiah 61 about, you know, being there to bring healing, and said that today this scripture's fulfilled in your hearing. And people obviously realize, you know, that Jesus is something special. And, you know, this official is an important example to us because he shows us faith in action. And one of the key components, it seems, to seeing miracles is having faith, the kind of faith that this official had. Now, faith is, according to Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, being sure of what we hope for, or having confidence in what we hope for, and assurance, being certain of what we do not see. So it's a lot more than just wishful thinking. It's a lot more than just hopefulness. You know, it's not just having a positive attitude or being optimistic. You know, some people are relatively confident in themselves. Others, you know, are more doubtful or sceptical by nature. But faith in the Bible is about having confidence, not in ourselves, but in God. Faith is always this living, breathing thing that can be hard for us to pin down or quantify because it's based on an invisible God. The writer to the Hebrews goes on to say that even just believing in God requires faith. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. You know, we weren't present, any of us, at creation. We can't definitively know from our own experience what happened there. And that applies to scientists as well, even though they tell you that they know. But by faith we believe that God spoke the universe into being, and that something visible is now here, as a result of what God did and said. And the writer goes on to say, without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Faith always rests in the character of God. It will always require a stretching of our faith muscles. Got a picture here of somebody doing exercise, you know, lunges and all that. You know, but faith ultimately rests in who God is, in his character, and it will be stretched at times like a muscle. You know, we're not talking about blind faith here. There's a lot that we can learn, that we can test from the Bible and from our experiences. We can have this confidence and assurance in God, but often that doesn't necessarily mean we're 100% certain of things. You know, God calls us to trust him. And the idea is that we've got a relationship with God that's personal and ever-growing. You can't really trust somebody that you don't know. And if our faith is to grow, our knowledge of God has to grow and our personal relationship with him has to develop. Now, this official hadn't actually seen Jesus heal his son when he came. The miracle that he longed for was in the future, but he believed that Jesus had the power to do that. And he came to Jesus and he begged for this miracle of healing. And he obeyed Jesus when Jesus said, "Go, your son will live." We're told that he took Jesus at his word and departed. And so he demonstrates to us what real faith it looks like, because faith listens to what Jesus says, rather than what other people may say, rather than what, you know, our own minds or our own hearts may tell us. And it acts on what Jesus says. It acts on what God says. And if we're going to see miracles in our own lives and in the lives of people around us, we've got to come to Jesus with our needs and requests. We've got to listen to what Jesus says, and we've got to act on it. And that's it in a nutshell. You know, there's nothing really complicated about a life of faith. We complicate it because we bring our doubts and our fears and everything else into it. You know, our anxieties, our worries, all those things sort of cloud our faith at times. And we magnify those things. We make those things bigger and bigger until they're giants before us. But faith sees God as almighty and the problems of his life as microscopic in comparison. Matt Redman says of worship, worship is about magnifying the right things. It can be so easy to let the struggles of this life become all-consuming, and we mustn't ignore them. But when we worship, instead of magnifying and focusing on these things, we magnify and focus on the name, the strength, the power, the grace of Jesus. And when we do that, it puts everything into perspective. And certainly, a life of faith has got to focus on who God is and what he has done so that faith grows within us. We can please God then because we trust in him to do what is good and what is needful in our lives and in the world. Now, Jesus recognized that miracles, these signs and wonders, were often demanded by people as proof. Proof of his identity, proof of his ability, proof that he was connected to God. He says to the official, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will never believe. But the irony is that faith doesn't automatically flourish even when miracles do happen. You know, later, after his resurrection, Jesus had a lot to teach Thomas. Thomas hadn't been present when he first appeared to the disciples. He struggled to believe that Jesus could be alive again. And graciously, Jesus met Thomas. He allowed him to see and touch his wounds and come to faith through that evidence. But he said to Thomas, because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who've not seen and yet have believed. You know, Jesus understood our human need for evidence. You know, for proof, for signs and wonders. Often he accommodated that need. But he also understood that faith sees with a different kind of vision. Faith can flourish even when there seems to be little visible evidence that what God says will happen. You know, faith takes God's words and hides them away in your heart. A little bit like Mary. We're told that the prophecies that Anna and Simeon gave when Jesus was in that temple, later on when he was in that temple, age 12, that she hid all those things in her heart. She treasured them. She pondered them. She didn't really understand what was going to happen, but she kept those words there, alive within her. And, you know, it's the same thing as what the psalmist tells us to do. He says, I've hidden your word in my heart so that I won't sin against you. People of faith, they have to come to Jesus. That's the first step. But then they need to hear what Jesus says and believe it, no matter how ridiculous it might, you know, look to their natural eyes or how daft it might sound. You know, this official had come to Jesus requesting him to go back to Capernaum with him to heal his son. But when Jesus said, go, your son will live, the official didn't try to argue or persuade Jesus to go. Like another official who recognized the authority of Jesus in another healing, and he was willing to do whatever Jesus said. He took Jesus at his word and he obeyed. And when we do the same, we'll be blessed and we'll be led, you know, to see the miraculous, because we need this spiritual vision that these glasses on the slide demonstrate. So the miracle actually happened to this official's son. It says, while he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that the boy was living. His boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday, at 1 PM, the fever left him. Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus said to him, your son will live. So he and his whole household believed. The miracle came at that moment when Jesus spoke to him. Now, the official didn't find out about that straight away, but when his servants tell him the time of healing, he realizes that it's Jesus' words which have made the difference. Your son will live. They had power to remove fever, restore health. And Jesus didn't have to be physically present in Capernaum to do that. His words could work healing from Cana while his son was in Capernaum. We've been praying today for people who aren't physically present with us, in our midst, but we believe that God's power can touch them and heal them where they are. You know, Jesus' words transcended distance. They overcame any barriers of place. They showed beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus' words had the authority of God. They were not ordinary words. And a miracle, we've said, is something that God does. It's something extraordinary. It's something beyond our experience or our power. We don't do miracles. God does. But it seems from this account and others that faith is an ingredient that God finds essential for doing miracles. And it's a little bit like lighting the blue touch paper on a firework. Now, we often go to official events now, don't we, with fireworks rather than doing it. But when I was a child, you know, bonfire night, my dad would buy a few fireworks and we'd be in our back garden and he would light the blue touch paper, place on a level surface, light the blue touch paper and retire immediately. So, you know, you'd set the fireworks off. And you needed that little spark, didn't you, to set the fireworks whooshing off, looking, you know, quite impressive. And that, in effect, is what happens. Somehow, and I don't understand how, but somehow our faith acts as a trigger, prompting God to work. It's as if he's looking for eager, expectant people who won't allow what they see with their natural eyes to define their world. And when he finds people like that, people with faith, he loves to demonstrate his power in ways that defy our natural laws. And conversely, we're told that Jesus didn't do many miracles in his hometown because of their lack of faith. A lack of faith is a bit like pouring cold water onto the firework. Yeah, trying to light the firework after that and then, you know, wondering why it's a damp squib and it's not going anywhere. If we've got no expectation of God working miracles, if we've got no anticipation of the miraculous in our daily lives, if our experience of God is that we can explain and work out everything that he does, then we're going to live disappointed, frustrated lives. We won't see the miraculous much at all. Because God is so much more than just a cultural experience. He's more than this nice word who guarantees us a safe future. God is alive. He's powerful. He's real. And when we read the Bible, we find people in desperate situations, but they don't stay in those situations forever. As they come to God in the person of Jesus Christ, they find answers to their situations. They find a person who's able to speak life. The blind can see, the deaf can hear. The ones lying at death's door are restored to health and vigour. God hasn't changed. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. This is our God. So we can expect God to work in the same way today. We can expect him to heal, to restore, to bring life and light into situations. We can expect him to save, to bring people into his kingdom. We can expect God to move in miraculous ways because that is who God is. Now, our expectations mustn't become presumptions, but we can't just always, you know, explain God away with no faith. The psalmist said, "In the morning, O Lord, you hear my voice. In the morning, I lay my requests before you and wait in expectation." Waiting expectantly before God's essential if we're to see the miraculous. You know, having that eager anticipation is another characteristic of faith. We need to come into God's presence with expectation and anticipation, confident that he's here to meet us in our time of need. You know, the royal official in this story is an inspiration to us because of his eager anticipation that in Jesus his needs will be met. You know, many of us will go anywhere to have needs met rather than God. We'll go to the doctors, we'll go to social media for advice, we'll listen to anyone who's got suggestions, we'll try the wackiest ideas to help us, but we don't come to God expectantly or with the faith that not only can he help us, but he really wants to help us and bless us. And this official begged Jesus to help his son. You know, that word implies he was desperate. He was resolved. He was determined. He knew that Jesus was the only one who could help. He'd got no other suggestions, no other solutions. He'd reached rock bottom. And often it's when we reach rock bottom, when we're at the end of our tether, that we see the miraculous. You know, while ever we've got ideas and solutions and suggestions and ways out, we don't really need God to step in. But when we understand that we've got no way to help ourselves, we come to God and we beg him to step in. It's not nice to reach rock bottom, but sometimes it's necessary for us to come to God with that same kind of desperate faith. Our God is a merciful, compassionate God. He loves us. He's just waiting for that moment when we cry out to him. You know, David, at a time of great personal difficulty, when he was on the run from King Saul, he was pretending to be insane before the Philistine ruler said, "This poor man called, and the Lord heard him. He saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers them." You know, David's testimony in the difficult days of persecution by Saul, when he was on the run, he was fearing for his life, was that God saved him out of all his troubles. He experienced God's deliverance. And the royal official in this account had the same testimony. Yeah? When Jesus spoke the words, "Your son lives," healing, deliverance came to his son. And the result was an increase in faith, a greater trust in the power of Jesus to turn things around. Personal difficulties shouldn't destroy our faith. They should be the springboard for us to come to Jesus in desperation. And then we see, like David, the rescue and the deliverance of our loving God. Every miracle comes when there's trouble. If there's no trouble, there's no need, then we don't need a miracle. But if we need a miracle, God is able to give us what we need. You might feel you need a miracle today. And if you do, let faith arise in your heart as you think about this second sign of Jesus. Let faith not only arise, but grow and develop. Yeah? It's a little bit like that mustard seed. As Jesus said, you know, there was an incident when there was a man with a child who was demon-possessed, and he asked Jesus' disciples to cast out the demon, and they couldn't. And they came to Jesus and they said, "Why? Why couldn't we do that?" And he said, "Because you have so little faith. Truly I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." We need that mustard seed faith. We need our faith to grow and increase as Jesus speaks living words to us. You know, our faith needs to flourish, to be stretched, so that our eyes can see the invisible by faith. And as a result of our faith, then, we will actually see in the reality of our daily lives what we've heard in that secret place with God. Paul said of Abraham, who's our father in all matters of faith, "He is our father in the sight of God in whom we believed, the God who gives life to the dead and who calls into being things that were not." When the official came to Jesus, his son was close to death. But when Jesus spoke, his son was healed. Things that were not suddenly were. Healing and life and restoration all came as Jesus spoke God's words of authority and life into that situation. And we come to Jesus. We ask for his help, yeah? We listen to his word and we act on what he says. Those are the four steps, really, the four building blocks of faith. If you could just move on, Gary. Yeah? We've got these four. We've got one block. That first block is coming to Jesus. The second block, we actually ask for his help. The third block, we listen to what he says. And then the fourth, we act on what he says. When we do that, the miraculous happens. We're given signs and wonders which point to the power that's in the presence of Jesus. The signs aren't there just to, you know, excite us, make us feel good. They're not necessarily for the crowd. You know, the crowd didn't follow the royal official home to Capernaum. Perhaps they didn't really believe Jesus' words had the power to change the situation. But these miracles are to build faith in those who trust God enough to ask for help. And if we're in that position, then we can be sure that God will meet us with the miraculous when necessary, just as he did with this man. Sign faith is the starting point. It's not the end point. You know, Jesus wants people whose faith is grounded in his word, not in miracles. It's his word that's powerful. It's his word which changes situations. And our prayer is that his word will come to us in power and in signs and wonders so that our faith will grow and our obedience will follow on, so that our lives become testimonies of who God is and what he does for ordinary people in Goldthorpe. Amen.